Neil Gaiman has been called, quote, the most famous author you've never heard of. Although by now, you've probably heard of him. Pretty much everything Gaiman touches becomes a bestseller. He's written the influential 75-issue comic book series Sandman, Doctor Who episodes on television, and terrific novels such as American Gods. He has more books coming out this summer, and he's getting ready for a live multimedia performance at Carnegie Hall in New York. And despite that insane schedule, or maybe because of it, he is here with me now. Neil Gaiman, welcome back to Studio 360.
It's wonderful to be back.
Let's start by listening to a version of the show you'll be doing soon at Carnegie Hall. You'll be reading your story, Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains, set to a live score by the string quartet called Foreplay.
For breakfast, I made porridge and threw in some dried plums to soften them. The mountains were black and grey against the white of the sky. We saw eagles, huge and ragged of wing, circling above us. Callum set a sober pace, and I walked beside him, taking two steps for every one of his. How long? I asked him. A day. Perhaps two. It depends upon the weather. If the clouds come down, then 2 days, or even three. The clouds came down at noon. And the world was blanketed by a mist that was worse than rain. Droplets of water hung in the air, soaked our clothes and our skin.
That's Neil Gaiman and the group Foreplay in a version of their performance of The Truth is a Cave, which came out 4 years ago, I think, and now it's this show, and now it's a graphic novel as well. What is it about this story that made you want to put it out in these other iterations?
It's like so much that I do. It was pure serendipity. I was asked by Sydney Opera House to do something on their stage. They said, you've got 2 hours. And at the time, I was editing an anthology called Stories, which, oddly enough, you had a story in. And I just finished my story for Stories, The Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains. And I thought, well, this would work. The promoter said Foreplay String Quartet might be great with this. He sent me some of their music. I listened to their versions of the Simpsons theme and the Doctor Who theme and thought, these are so imaginative and brilliant. Absolutely. And I suggested Eddie Campbell as an artist just to do, at the time, 15 paintings because he's Scottish and I know the stuff he does will actually look and feel like Scotland and be historically accurate. It's a story set in the 17th century in Jacobean times.
Your most recent novel, as far as I know, is The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which is just out in paperback. It starts with the narrator's visit, a narrator perhaps like you, a middle-aged English guy, his visit to his childhood home in Sussex in the south of England, which stirs up all kinds of forgotten memories of his childhood. You did grow up in a town in Sussex. I'm not going to ask, and did all these weird and magical things happen to you? But was there some instance of going back home and...
I mean, the what you are very, very politely skirting about is how autobiographical is this in some ways. And it's very, very autobiographical, except wherever it isn't. I wrote the book because I missed my wife. She's a musician, a songwriter, a recording artist. And 2 years ago, she went to Melbourne, Australia, to record an album. And I thought, well, I could send her flowers, but why don't I write her a short story? I'll give her a story that tells her what the world was like looking out through my eyes when I was 7. And it won't quite have my family in, but it'll absolutely be set in the house that I lived in. And I will throw in a little magic because I'm me and that's how I like to write. So that was the starting point. But from my perspective, it was much, much more personal, more honest, more awkward than the fiction that I would normally put into a novel.
I want you to read a bit from the book. From when the narrator steps into the pond in the childhood neighbor's backyard, the ocean of the book's title, he's already underwater.
I did not choke. I felt the coldness of the water, if it was water, pour into my nose and my throat, felt it fill my lungs. But that was all it did. It did not hurt me. I thought, this is the kind of water you can breathe. I thought, perhaps there is just a secret to breathing water, something simple that everyone could do, if only they knew. That was what I thought. That was the first thing I thought. The second thing I thought was that I knew everything. I saw the world I had walked since my birth, and I understood how fragile it was, that the reality I knew was a thin layer of icing on a great dark birthday cake, writhing with grubs and nightmares and hunger. I saw the world from above and below. I saw that there were patterns and gates and paths beyond the real. I saw all these things and understood them, and they filled me, just as the waters of the ocean filled me.
That was Neil Gaiman reading from his novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. There's a point at which this guy gets out of the ocean having just glimpsed the meaning of existence and then loses the thread and can't really remember. And which I realized as I read the novel corresponded to a moment in my childhood where I thought, okay, I've got to write everything down that I'm thinking right now or I won't have it when I get older. Which seems something like what motivates a lot of your work, that trying to get back into that portal that to lost knowledge of childhood.
I remember being a kid and reading books by adults for children, with children in them, and going, you don't remember.
Exactly.
You have
You're
no
pretending.
Idea. You're faking this.
Yeah.
And going, is that going to happen to me? Am I going to grow up and forget? I have to remember. I have to be one of the ones who remembers. Some of these people remember. And that was important. Although, strangely, the ocean, that little moment of remembering everything and forgetting was something that happened to me when I was about 11, younger. I would have been about 10. And I was strangled by a actually vaguely well-meaning older kid who at that point
well, he was a well-meaning strangler.
He was a well-meaning strangler. We had ties. We're kids in an English school. You wore a tie. You wore a shirt and tie. And my tie was loose. And he came up and he was like, do your tie up, and pulled it tight and walked away. And I stumbled around for a moment and then collapsed. And he found me a few minutes later walking back the other way and the other kids had thought I was pretending or something stupid was happening. So and he came over and undid my tie and I started breathing. And I remember the sensation of coming up from deep waters. And I remember feeling that I had known everything just for a while in there, just for a moment. I'd known everything and now I was back in the real world. And it was
Heaven
fading.
Is for Real by Neil Gaiman.
Exactly.
You recently put out an album with your wife, Amanda Palmer, which is a collection of songs and readings from what I like to think of as your honeymoon tour of 2011 together. I want to play a clip from the album of you and Amanda performing the song Makin' Whoopee, speaking of honeymoons.
Another bride, another tune, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. The groom is nervous, he answers twice. It's really killing that he's so willing to make whoopee.
That was Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews, and that was the song Makin' Whoopee from the album An Evening with Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer. Given that she comes to this in terms of your public joint persona with a certain fan base, you come with a certain fan base, how much do in a Venn diagram, how much do they overlap?
They overlap, but not entirely. The doing the evening with Amanda Palmer and Neil Gaiman things was like, it's like at a wedding when both sides get to come together and somebody at the door could say, are you with the bride?
Yeah.
Are you with the groom?
And some of them make friends.
And they do, and then they breed. The strange thing for me, of course, is when Amanda and I first talked about it, I was very clear in my head what would be happening on these things. She would sing, and I would read things.
Mm-hmm.
And she was equally as clear on what would happen, which is she would sing, I would read things, and she would get me to sing. And she won.
One thing you're known as in my household is as the author of American Gods, which I understand is finally becoming a television series. And now as a fan, I demand to know when and where it's going to appear on television.
I cannot tell you. All I can tell you is that
then this interview is over, Neil Gaiman. No.
We are in the process. It's being done with a television company called Fremantle. They are in the process of hiring the perfect person as a showrunner. And I am watching all this with pride and a little bit of nervousness.
Does it excite you, given that we've now established for 20 years the golden age of television, that it's a television series as opposed to a movie?
Yeah, it does. Mostly because it was published in 2001. And after that, approximately once a year, I would get a phone call from a famous director that you've heard of. You know, a different one each time. Mm-hmm. The phone would ring and a voice would say, hello, I am a famous director that you have heard of. And I would go, gosh, it's an honor. And they'd say, I picked up your book, American Gods, and it's just fantastic. And I want to make it into a movie. And I'd go, oh, this is great. And they'd say, and I've just got one question. And I'd say, what is that? And they'd say, how? Because it's too big and it's not really movie-shaped. And what ideas have you got? And I would go, well, I don't really know. If I'd had an idea for a book that was movie-shaped, I would have written that instead of this big sort of lumpy, giant, weird thing with all of this stuff happening. So from my perspective, it's great. It's gone from being a bug to being a feature.
Yes.
It was for years a bug. It wasn't small and movie-shaped.
Yeah.
And now the fact that it is bulbous and baggy and
with too many characters.
Too many characters that goes off all over the place and stuff.
It's an extra season.
It's great. So I'm
and finally, for people who envy you and your life, and there are obviously many, many reasons to do so. You're 53.
Yeah.
You got your hair. You're not fat. You're married to a Lollapalooza. is there anything wrong with your life that I'm being serious, that would console people that, oh yeah, he's got that.
You know, I would love more time to write. This year, I took myself off social media from January until May, partly just to be bored. I want dead time. I want to stare out of the window if I'm in a cab and just think about things. I would love more time to write. I miss that. That is my sane place. That is the stuff that fixes me. That's that when I feel broken, when I'm tired, when I'm hurt, when I'm upset. Going away and writing is my way of putting the world in order.
I hear you. Neil Gaiman, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Ken.
Neil Gaiman will appear at New York's Carnegie Hall later this month, performing his story, The Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains.